Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast. This week, I have the pleasure of chatting with Jacqueline Gottlieb, Professor of Neuroscience at the Kavli Institute for Brain Science and the Mortimer B. Zuckerman Institute for Mind, Brain, and Behavior at Columbia University in New York. Since joining the Columbia faculty in 2001, she has spearheaded pioneering research on the neural mechanisms of attention and curiosity, using computational modeling combined with behavioral and neurophysiological studies in humans and non-human primates. Please join me today as Professor Gottlieb unlocks the fundamental forces governing curiosity. She begins by explaining the ambiguity inherent in uncertainty and the balance between potential risks and rewards. Then she reviews a recent study that suggests that we don't always reason optimally about uncertainty. After discussing potential reasons why we might struggle with decision-making surrounding uncertainty, she highlights key personality factors from the study that were associated with more successful decision-making. Finally, she closes by sharing her hopes for the future of the field. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to our discussion about your research on curiosity. We're planning to start our conversation by focusing on your fascinating 2023 Nature Communications paper, Inefficient Prioritization of Task-Relevant Attributes During Instrumental Information Demand. Before we get into the specifics of today's paper, can you tell us a little bit about what curiosity actually is?
Hi, Julia. Very happy to be here. Yes, so curiosity is, I think, what we all think it is. It is the desire to know. And more simply, maybe it's asking questions.
Wow, what a fascinating topic of study. And why do you study curiosity? What are the big questions in that field?
I study curiosity because curiosity is, I think, one of the most important things about our behavior and our brain function, and also one of the least studied things, the most neglected things in our field. And we can go later on into why it's been neglected. But basically, curiosity, I think it forces you to think, forces us as psychologists and neuroscientists to think about brain and behavior in slightly different ways than we're used to think about them. So the bulk of research that people do in psychology or in neuroscience has to do with how people act and plan and think in worlds that are familiar to them, in the known, in the realm of the known. In the realm of the known, you have the ability to formulate goals. You have a knowledge. You know what state you are in at this moment. You know what is your desired state. And you also know the sequence of actions that is needed to take you from where you are now to where you want to be in the future. And that's what we call planning. And all of these things rely on familiarity and a lot of knowledge that you have about your environment. But curiosity forces us to realize that this realm of the known is really a tiny realm of the world, right? So this, some of our knowledge is like an island, a small island in the ocean. And we're used to live on the island, and all of our focus is on the island. How do you act on that island of knowledge? But the ocean is enormous and it's vast, right? And it's larger than we can ever conquer. So all we can do is extend our island a little bit, but we're never going to cover the entire ocean. And I think that our brains are somehow aware of this evolutionarily. We have evolved because we can never get rid of the ocean. We can never reach a state where everything is known and we can always do our plans and pursue our goals based on what we know. That's never going to be the case. And so evolution has built into our brains this awareness, if you want, that there's always a vast ocean of unknown things out there, vast ocean of uncertainty. And evolution has also equipped us with a path, a way to transition between the known and the unknown, and specifically to extend what we know. And those mechanisms are what we think of curiosity. So curiosity is that set of mechanisms that allows us to cross that boundary of our island. And I really do think that this is why we need a brain at all to begin with. Organisms can survive perfectly well with a very small subset of information, just doing the same thing, just doing a stereotyped sequence of actions. Think of an amoeba or a single cell organism. It can get energy and survive perfectly well. It doesn't need a brain for that. Where you need a brain is where you start wanting to expand this repertoire and to deal with the knowns and unknowns and expand the sphere of what is known. And particularly if you think of a big brain like humans have, that's absolutely what the brain is for. And in our in traditional approaches to psychology and neuroscience, we tend to approve curiosity because there's so much to think about in the realm of the known. Like how do we set goals? How do we plan? How do we think? And there's a ton of stuff to think about just there. But I think that as we have become more and more sophisticated, certain findings start to not make sense. So if you think that people are adapted just to act in very well-known familiar environments, certain aspects of behavior, certain aspects of our brains just start to not make sense. And I think that the only way to make sense of them is to really think about that we're not really adapted for habitual familiar environments. We're really adapted to deal with the unknowns. And so I think the time of this question has really come.
And if this question about what is curiosity, about how we employ curiosity, about how we venture off this island into the ocean is so critical, why do you think it is understudied?
There might be several answers to that. Why it's understudied. One is because maybe that's, in a sense, the limits of the brain looking into itself. So obviously we are concerned when we do introspection, we are aware of, again, mostly things that we know. So I look around and I'm aware and I see that there's a car over there and there's a flower over there and those are walls and those are floors and that's my house and that's my kitchen. And if I want food, I go there. And if I want entertainment, I go somewhere else, and so on and so forth, right? And so those are the things that we are aware of. If I look out the window and I think, wow, there's a cloud out there and I have really no idea what's going on in there, in the cloud, if I stop to think about it, right? Those things are farther away from our consciousness, farther away from our awareness. Because we have less knowledge about it, right? Less specific knowledge. And we should talk about uncertainty is not nothing. Uncertainty is something, but it's not concrete, well-defined knowledge. And so when we as researchers introspect about what is interesting to study about the brain, our introspections lead us to stuff that we know because that's what we're aware of, right? And it's somehow more difficult. So in a sense, the brain has tricked us too, right? Because this is what it gives us to be aware of. And this is what we think that's what's interesting to study. There have been people who thought about, it just takes an extra step to think, oh, but what about uncertainty? What about exploration? What about how do we deal with that? It's certainly possible to think that way. And there have been psychologists and neuroscientists who thought about that. But I just think it's not the mass of the field. it's maybe 20% research efforts. I think they should be closer to 98%.
Wow. Okay.
We should be talking about this because this is the most important thing. But this brings us to the second reason, which is that it is more difficult to model curiosity and to understand it computationally, right? I think it requires more sophisticated models and ways of thinking. And in a sense, the fact that our fields have focused so much on known familiar environments, I think that it has set the building blocks and the tools that we can now use and treat this more challenging construct of curiosity.
So because of that foundation of exploration on this known island, we now have a foundation that makes this a propitious time to study curiosity?
Yes, I think so. And also because we have studied actions in a known environment for so long. And again, we're getting more and more sophisticated about understanding those actions. And we're starting to talk about decisions, not only very simple decisions, but more complex decisions and planning on longer timescales. I think also for understanding those decisions, almost the concept of uncertainty is just right there. It appears. The more complex you make a behavior, the more uncertainty and curiosity and things like that are becoming essential to understand them. So it comes from both, right? So both, because we want to understand more, we have to tackle this, but we can also tackle it because we dealt with the more basic behaviors.
Really interesting. And before we get to the actual paper, while we're still on the topic of curiosity, it seems in general, there's an ambivalence about curiosity, about whether it's really a positive characteristic or whether people are concerned about it. This familiar proverb of curiosity killed the cat. Can you share your insights on these contrasting perspectives about curiosity?
I think this ambivalence and this duality goes really straight to the heart of the matter. So you can think about behavior as basically the need to make a decision between two things. Approach or avoid, right? So if you think, I find it easy to reduce it. So think about an amoeba swimming in the ocean, right? All that amoeba needs to survive is a receptor, some sort of sensor that tells it where nutrients are. Let's say the thing feeds on glucose. It needs to be able to sense it needs a receptor for glucose, and it needs to follow a gradient. So if it senses glucose, it will approach it. And then one more thing that it needs is some sort of sensor for poisons, the stuff to avoid, right? And that sensor for poison doesn't have to be very fine-grained, doesn't have to be very specific. The amoeba doesn't need to know what kind of poison it is. It only needs to know, don't go there. So we can lump together any number of poisons just so it knows to not randomly tumble into them. So this is the basis of life, the basis of interaction with the environment, approach or avoid. And if you look at the way mammalian brains are structured, the way the human brains is structured even, that approach-avoid duality is there in our brains, even in very elaborate structures. So now, of course, we as humans or higher order animals use a lot more information. We have a lot more sensors than the amoeba, right? We don't just sense glucose. We sense an enormous number of things, and we can create very elaborate paths to the rewards that we need to survive. And so our planning is much more complex, of course, but at the basis of it is the same question. Do I go there? Do I go to this place or do I avoid that place? What do I do? Approach or avoidance. Okay. So now when we're in familiar environments, I think what makes those, a huge part of what makes those environments familiar is that we know the motivational significance of things, right? If I'm hungry, a restaurant is a thing to approach. If I got sick at that restaurant last time I ate there, that's a thing to avoid, right? So we know the motivation. So the approach avoid maps, you can call it a map of salience or map of meaning. they are given. They're given to us. And so we can make our decisions. Go there, don't go there. Now, what is uncertainty? What if we have an environment that we do not know? Sometimes people think that is, you don't know. So there's nothing in there. But that's not really true. Because the moment we come into that environment, we need a map of meaning wherever we go. And so we assume that environment has meaning for us. We assume that shiny new thing. Let's say I have something that looks like an extraterrestrial ship coming down here. Just by the virtue of me sensing, my brain needs to put meaning in it. Is it a thing I need to approach or is it a thing I need to avoid? And if it's new, I'm going to bring all my previous knowledge to it and I'm going to make some generalizations, right? If I've seen a ship on the last movie, maybe that I think that's a friendly, or depending on the movie, I might think that's bad. But in any case, because that thing is new, it's going to evoke both tendencies in me. It's going to evoke approach and avoid.
Oh, wow.
And that's what we call uncertainty. It's not that there's nothing. It's actually too much because we cannot make a decision. We cannot make a choice. So this also explains why it's a state of very high arousal, because all of a sudden it engages a lot more of our brain. It's not a state that our brain likes to be in. It's very energetically expensive. And we tend to resolve it. That's why our brain is, okay, figure it out, learn something or make a decision or something. Okay. But now we were talking about why curiosity is ambivalent. That's exactly why it's ambivalent, because it evokes fear at the same time that it evokes hope. It's approach and avoidance at the same time. And in fact, if you look at the reactions to the autonomic reactions to novelty, right, they involve both elements, right? Both elements. So an animal that sees a sudden thing or a new thing, it will freeze, which is a defensive reaction. But it would also have enhanced cognition, which is in a sense an approach reaction. I'm investigating this thing. I'm engaging with it. I don't just let it go away. I'm engaging with it and trying to figure it out. So you have both approach and avoidance. And that's where the duality comes from, right? So the duality, so there is hope in curiosity. Things could turn out better than you knew them. There's also always a risk. You could have a short-term risk in order to have a longer-term reward, and most exploration is like that. And another thing that I wanted to mention, like this duality, is that in a social context, curiosity is not only dangerous to us, it could also be dangerous to others. So what curiosity gives us, if it doesn't kill us, like cat, then it gives us something super powerful, which is knowledge.
Right.
Which is the ability to predict. So I learn, I'm controlling a new piece of my environment. And as an individual, controlling it. But the next fellow does not have that knowledge. Then I am much more powerful than the next person next to me. And so then I can become a potential threat. So again, that can be for the next fellow next to me. It could be either good or bad. If they can cooperate with me and get my knowledge, then that's good. But if I turn out to be a threat and use my knowledge against them, that's bad. So there's this duality of good or bad, both from the actual material that you're learning and from other agents that interact with it, which explains why curiosity is such a tightly regulated social phenomenon, right? Every single tyrant in history will try to squash curiosity. That's one of the first things you want to squash. You want to squash questions. You want to squash independent thinking, because that is obviously potentially a threat, right? And on the other hand, I think societies that are super, super successful are those that manage to allow independent exploration from multiple agents and find a way in which the knowledge can be shared cooperatively. But anyway, so this duality of good and bad is totally intrinsic to anything that's uncertain.
Discussing this duality, you've already started to hint at different reasons why we might seek information. Maybe we're hopeful and we think we're going to learn good news. Maybe we're concerned and we want to reduce our potential danger. Why do those motives matter?
Those motives matter because we need a motive, right? Because information doesn't just come to us. This, by the way, is another one of those huge oversimplifications that we have used in psychology and neuroscience, whose time has come to go away. And again, I think that it's also related to this introspection illusion, right? So when you open your eyes in the morning, right, what do you think? You think the world is right there. I see where I am. Information is given to me. It's right there. There's nothing I need to do to extract it from the environment. Nothing can be further from the truth. In fact, your brain works super hard. It doesn't get information. All the brain gets is a bunch of signals that hit the sensors, a bunch of photons, a bunch of airwaves, a bunch of chemicals that hit our noises, which in and of themselves are meaningless. There's a jumble of noise. And the only way we can make sense of it is we impose order. We interpret what's there. And in our brains, through evolution, but also as you wake up as an individual, we expend a lot of energy to interpret those signals meaningfully. And not only do we interpret those signals meaningfully, but we seek out very particular signals. Because again, what comes from the environment is way too much. It's pretty much infinite. It will totally can overwhelm our processing capacity. So we very selectively decide what to focus on. And there's studies of inattentional blindness that show how people are we're not aware of, I don't know, maybe more than 99.99% of what's going on around us. Some things we just don't see, even though they're super obvious. So I'm tempted to ask you, if you close your eyes now and tell me, what color are my glasses?
Oh, wow. I really have no idea. Maybe silver?
Oh, my God. Perfect. See, you've been staring at me for, 30 minutes. Okay, so point taken. But it's not just you. We all do this. It's truly incredible how if we don't need the information, it just shows you that even registering something as obvious, the color of my glasses, has a cost for your brain. And that cost is actually quite significant. I'm sure you remember perfectly fine what I've been saying, and you're processing the meaning of that, and you're thinking deeply beyond it, and so on and so forth. You're thinking about a lot of things. The color of my glasses is totally irrelevant. And so your brain did exactly the right thing in saying, I'm not going to bother with this thing right now. Okay, but the point that I want to make is that your brain has made a decision, a very sophisticated decision, what to process and what not to process. That decision is totally hidden from your awareness.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that I would call an exploratory decision, because I decided how to expend my cognitive resources on a particular piece of information. So that is an exploratory decision. Okay, so why were you asking? Oh, you're asking why are the motives so important? And so if you're just very naive and you say information is given to me, I don't need to make any effort in processing it. I'm not selecting it. It's right there. That's saying, I see the sun go around the earth, therefore the sun must go around the earth. Phenomenologically, yes, that is what happens. The sun goes around the earth. Nobody's disputing that. But deep down, it's just the other way around. The earth goes around the sun.
Right.
And so here, deep down, it's the information is not given to you. Meaningless noise is given to you, and you make decisions about what to process, what to pay attention to, what is significant. Okay, so now it's your own decision.
Right.
So now you need a mechanism for making that decision. And the first thing about a decision is you need a motivation. What are you trying to achieve with that decision? why, so your, let's say your brain decided to focus on my voice rather than on the color of my glasses. How did it make that decision? What did it want to accomplish? And how does it know that it accomplished that?
Right.
Okay. And this is the question that people have ignored or avoided and was hidden. Because again, if I think that the sun goes around the earth, and if I think that God put the sun around the earth, then I don't need to think. There is no question. I don't need to ask, why is the earth going around the sun? It's not going around the sun. And I told you already, God makes the sun go around the earth and I'm done. But now if you unpack that and I say, okay, no, actually the earth goes around the sun. And then how does that happen? And God doesn't make it. Maybe God is not involved, but then how? What is the mechanism? Okay. So, all right, here as well. So once you say, okay, your brain has to do something active about information, then you have to understand, how does it make that decision?
And why is it making that
decision? And why is that making that decision? And then you have to think, okay, so let's say the brain is seeking information, is seeking one particular sensory signal versus another. What is information? What is that really for the brain? And the best way, there's several ways to think about information, but the best way, the theoretically motivated way, is to think of it as uncertainty.
Right.
And again, uncertainty is not nothing. Uncertainty is, mathematically speaking, involves having a set of possibilities and a distribution of outcomes over those possibilities. And in particular, if you have uncertainty, you have a more flat distribution of outcomes. Meaning that when you're attending to what I'm saying, how would I program that? How would I write a mathematical equation for that? I would have to say, you have uncertainty. You are imagining several things that I may be saying. First of all, you have an idea about the set, about the topic we're talking about. You have an idea about what I wrote before. You do have some hypotheses, even if they're unconscious. Your brain has generated those hypotheses. But you never know what I'm going to say next. You can't fully predict the next word. So you have some uncertainty about it. And your brain says, okay, you should resolve your uncertainty about what the words are and right and what they convey. You should resolve that uncertainty. Now, that's a value proposition.
Right.
So your brain says this particular... Now, you might also have a question about, oh, what color are Jackie's glasses? That's another question. And you might have a set of possibilities and some uncertainty about that, right?
Absolutely.
But your brain is saying, don't worry about that. That has low value. That particular question has low value right now. And the question about what Jackie is saying has higher value. So you see how both signals, so you have uncertainty. If you're uncertain about what I'm saying, you want to reduce that. But you also have to have selected the uncertainty that you want to reduce. And that's a value proposition. So that's where uncertainty and reward are both important. And then you can see how they go together, right? Because, for example, imagine that I started repeating myself. Imagine that I started repeating myself. Imagine that I started repeating myself. Imagine, okay, you'd be like, whoa, okay, there's no more information here to be gotten. There's no more uncertainty. And also that reduces the value of this particular signal.
Right.
Let's just walk away and look for something more exciting. Right. So you see how, so uncertainty and reward, mathematically, they're distinct, and they are distinct in many ways, but you see how they work together to determine what we're interested in. Yeah.
Interesting. So it sounds like we can treat information either as a good unto itself, as something that we want to seek, or as the means to potentially seeking a reward. And it sounds like a lot of us love receiving good news. We want to seek good news. How could a strategy based upon seeking that reward be problematic or undermine the real goals?
Yeah. Yeah. So here's where it gets complicated, because we absolutely need, in order to effectively seek information or effectively explore, we need to consider both uncertainty and rewards. As I've said, if we need at some very high level, we need to have a notion that this particular question has some benefit for it, for me. It could be a very delayed benefit, or it could be a very immediate benefit. But I have to have some reason to engage with it. Again, it requires a lot of mental energy, a lot of brain power in order to learn, in order to process information. So I need to have to decide that this is worthwhile. So rewards are important, but rewards can also interfere and be misleading. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, rewards are, in a sense, you can't live with them and you can't live without them. So what we try to explore in this paper is a way in which rewards are interfering with efficient exploration. And the interference that we explored in this paper, this particular interference, I think it has to do with time scales of evaluation.
Oh, wow.
So the scenario that we explored in this paper is something like, I want to put it in an intuitive setting. So imagine that you enter a raffle or a vacation package, right? And you get a prize. And that prize includes a hotel and
a rental,
right? For a few days. Okay. So now the hotel, you know that the set of the hotels that you could possibly draw is pretty good. So let's say that the room that you get is going to be worth like around $500. And also, you know that the set of rooms in the raffle are pretty constant. Like they might range from $490 to $510, but they're really pretty close to $500. So you can predict pretty well that you're going to get $500 worth somewhere in there as a hotel room. And then you also get a car. And the car is worthless, but it has a bigger margin of error around it. So the set of cars that you can get is, let's say they range between $100 and $300. So it's a wider range there. And then I'm playing a little game with you. And I say, okay, you know what? You're going to have to wait until later on. You're going to learn the total of the hotel and the car. What's the total prize that you got? But I'm going to make you wait. But right now, I'm going to reveal to you the precise value of one of these items. So you tell me which one you want to know right away. Do you want to know the precise value of the hotel room that you got? Or do you want to know the precise value of the car? Which one would you choose?
And so if I wanted to reduce uncertainty, I would choose the car. But if I were really excited about the hotel and I just wanted to see what the hotel was, I would choose the hotel.
Exactly. So you see how, so here you have a reward, right? And I'm telling you that in general, it's obviously very adaptive to choose the high value thing.
Right.
But so the trick in this situation, what creates this conflict is that it is adaptive to think about the entire value of your package later on.
Right.
And that is the thing that you should want to predict more precisely. And as it happens, in order to predict that more precisely, you should inquire about the lower value thing right now, that individual component that has lower value, because that individual component doesn't determine the total, but it can reduce the uncertainty about the total the most. Right?
Right. And so in your study, you had participants doing a very similar task to this, where you had them choosing between a high value reward with low uncertainty or a low value reward like the car with higher uncertainty.
Yeah.
Why did you design it that way? What did you hope to learn by having participants do this task?
Exactly. I designed it this way because I do think those are the two fundamental determinants of curiosity, uncertainty and rewards. And I think that there is a conflict. There have been demonstrations in the literature that this kind of conflict exists. For example, there's a phenomenon in the literature that people sometimes call information avoidance. So if you think that the news about something are likely to be bad, people will avoid that news, even when they are useful in the future. Right. There's a phenomenon, I think, where grandmothers are the first ones to spot that there's maybe a developmental disability in their grandchild before the parents do.
Wow.
Because the parents, they just don't want to see the sign.
They don't want to know.
Right. Or doctor, the classical thing is the doctor calls you, you should come in. I got this test. We need to talk. People will put off that visit.
Right.
Even though it could obviously help them in the longer run, they're just so afraid of the short-termness of the news that they will avoid. So what you're avoiding is an immediate unpleasant mental state. So here, in a sense, we're trying to tap in a similar phenomenon, except that what we're doing is I'm making this study, I'm putting it in a competitive situation. So most previous studies did, okay, you have a situation and the value of the situation may be higher or lower, like a doctor's visit, that's maybe a lower value setting. And then the question is, do you have one question you can ask? Do you want to ask that question? Do you want to get that information? What I'm doing here is I'm keeping the value of the situation constant. So in my case, the value, like in the prize, the value of your whole package is constant and it's not in your control. It's whatever you draw for the hotel and whatever you draw for the car. That's the value. But what's in your control, you can choose to attend to two aspects of the situation. So you either attend the price of the hotel or attend to the price of the car. And that's basically an attentional question. So I'm very interested in how we orient our attention to obtain information. So the brain has to choose between two signals and it has to decide which one is more informative. And so it's just a totally open question. How does this, I set up a conflict between uncertainty reduction and immediate reward. And I want to see how it plays out in attention. And I think attention is super interesting because it really is what governs our every millisecond, how we get information millisecond by millisecond.
And so just to clarify here, you said that the overall level of reward is going to be held constant, but participants can either sample the high value reward or the low value reward. If the overall reward is held constant, wouldn't sampling either of them provide you how much the other one should be? Or what is the mechanism there?
No, because they're independent. So it's not the total reward will fluctuate in the example of the draws, the total reward would fluctuate. But that fluctuation is nothing that you can control. And so what you want to do is just predict how the total reward is, right? Exactly. And the best way to predict it is to look at the less exciting thing right now.
Right.
The thing that's individually less exciting.
Interesting. So you're really putting these two motives in conflict for the participant.
Exactly.
If I were the participant, did you assume as the experimenters that the participants would just do the mathematical calculation and think about what's their expected value? What's their, like, how are they going to optimize? Were you expecting the participants to do that math?
The thing about this is that, yes, you could do math, but it's more of a reasoning thing. Just like I asked you the question, when I ask you the question, which one would you inquire about? You don't really need to think that's 100 plus 300. You could do the math and you could compute all the possible sums of all the blah, blah, blah. And we have figure two in the paper where you can consider, I think you need to consider four different alternatives and the uncertainty about them. And you could do that. But instead, all you have to do is reason a very simple logical step and you can get the correct answer. And the correct answer is super simple. You should always look at the stimulus that has a bigger uncertainty to begin with, because that will afford you the better prediction later on. And you should totally ignore the value of it for this purpose. And that's it. And so once you figure it out, you just do one stereotyped thing. So it's a very easy thing to implement. You just have to do the reasoning correctly.
Did participants do the reasoning correctly?
No. It's really interesting. We come up and we've done this study now in a couple of ways. We've done it in two different experiments. The second experiment had several versions of it. And we always come up with this sort of magical figure where we have about 10% of people who get it correctly. And they really show evidence that they really are getting the rule. They really understand. And we didn't ask people how they solved this problem, how they approached it, but I'm pretty sure that those 10% would have given the right answer. And in this study that we're talking about, we even put a price. So we said, I'm going to reward you for making more accurate predictions about the sum. So you can ask for the price of one item. And then I'm going to ask you, do you think that the sum of the two items is greater or smaller than some value, than some threshold? And I'm going to give you a reward. I'm going to give you actual money if your answer is correct, right? So I'm incentivizing people to be very accurate. And that really, if you reason correctly and acquire the best information, you can be 100% correct. If you reason incorrectly and get the wrong information, you'll be a chance. So getting the correct information really can double your reward rates. It's a significant effect. And what we find is that people, on average, they became a little bit better when we put these kind of incentives. They became a little bit better. They inched a little bit towards the better strategy, uncertainty-driven strategy. But nobody made that step to say, oh, okay, now I know this is the correct way to behave and I'm going to behave like that all the time. So putting more incentives didn't really make them have an insight and say, okay, I know what to do and I'm going to do the right thing now.
Do you think that participants were sort of blinded by their desire to seek good news and find out the higher reward sooner?
I think so. I'm not sure that I was expecting people to be quite as inefficient as they were. I was totally open to the possibility that many people would really know what to do. And in particular, if I put a price on it, if I give them an incentive, there was a distinct possibility that people, like if they don't have incentives and it really doesn't change what they get based on what they look for, maybe they would be more relaxed and not be quite so efficient in how they request information. But I really thought there was a distinct possibility that once you make the incentive very clear, a lot of people will switch to be very optimal. Because again, it's such a simple thing to reason about once you get it correctly. So that was a distinct possibility. So in that sense, the fact that they didn't was a surprise. So then we found that they don't perform optimally. And then we had to start explaining. And while explaining and discussing the paper, and again, and so here I have to, we did not, those are questions for future research. So that's right. Not stuff we answer in that paper. So I'm just raising hypotheses, and actually there will be very exciting things to pursue, and we are pursuing them in future experiments. So I realized that one possibility is indeed related to the reward conflict. And this is how I came to this based on the previous literature. That's probably you want to have immediate good news, so to speak, even if they're not very helpful in the future. But there is another possibility. And that other possibility is that maybe people just do not reason very well based on uncertainty, right? So if you think about it, what we're asking people to do is to ignore the average value. When I describe this scenario to you, you think, oh, $500 versus $200. Okay, and $500 is better, right? So we reason first based on the average, based on the overall value, right? And in statistics, that's called the first moment of the distribution. That's intuitively easy for us. But I'm asking them to do this correctly. They have to reason on the second moment of the distribution, which is the spread, the uncertainty about the average. And I think that just our brains may be less wired to do this correctly. And especially when we are in the domain of symbolic knowledge, like we have here, the uncertainty is about values. And I'm expressing this in numbers and in words. So it's a very symbolic kind of knowledge. We also deal with uncertainty in our senses, in our sensory input, in our motor output. If I'm going to reach for something, can I catch it? Can I catch it fast enough? I have uncertainty in my reach. I have uncertainty in my actions. And it's possible that those kind of uncertainties, again, we don't reason about them explicitly, but the brain might be pretty good at dealing with them and correcting for them. There's evidence on that. But when it comes to more explicit kind of uncertainties, we also have some evidence that people find it really hard to think about those things. And so it's possible that people may have difficulty reasoning about this problem, even if you didn't have this value concept. Let's say we talked about two different attributes like size versus position, or something on the right is like the position of something is, you have position of a thing that's more predictable versus a position that's less predictable. And if you try to catch both things, what should you pay attention to? So now it's not that one has higher value than the other. The value conflict is not there, but people may still have problems acting based on uncertainty and knowing how to reduce that uncertainty.
If you have a lot of these participants who are performing non-optimally, hypothesizing about future studies here, do you think it's possible for them to learn the optimal strategy and improve over time?
Yeah. So this is something that's very much on our mind. Again, unexplored territory is an amazing research desert on this. How can people learn to improve their information seeking abilities? Again, and then that's because we didn't used to think that people seek information. We thought information is right there. There's nothing to see. Okay. But people do seek information, and there are hints out there in the literature that, yes, probably training is super important. So one hint that is familiar to many people is when you learn how to drive. I don't know if you remember or what your first driving experience was, but I remember my first driving experience, and it was on a manual car, and it was in a place that was hilly. They had to do a lot of starting uphill. And managing the clutch and the gas and the gear shifter. I'm like, what is this? Like too much. Too many things are going on at the same time. This is insane. And then as you learn, somehow it just becomes so much easier. And like, it's not too many things. It's one thing. You start the car. Right. This is how your brain packages it so efficiently. And there's evidence that if you look at people's eye movements, they reflect this. So initially, as somebody learns, their eye movements are all over the place. They look at the wrong thing. They're inefficient. And that goes with your subjective sense of confusion. But then as you have an experienced driver, their eye movements are incredibly machine-like, much more efficient. They skip over redundant things. They look at the new informative things. They're reproducible within a person, across people. And so I think there's a tremendous amount of learning going on in attention. And I think that we just haven't studied it. It's amazing how little we know about that. So again, and these are projects that we're now considering in my lab. And here, again, you have to think of it as at least two systems. So one is an implicit system, like this eye movement learning is something that you're probably not aware of. It takes a ton of practice. It probably uses our built-in sensory motor contingencies, right? So our brain has all the time, it coordinates eyes and movement with your skeletal movements and so on. So these are all very biological things. But then you can also ask about learning in this more symbolic domain, right? So how would I explain to somebody how to solve this problem? How would you train them without... Obviously, you could use explicit instruction, but that is a little less. You need a classroom setting for that. You need to make them go to university or something. But we're thinking about, and one direction that we're thinking of is can we relate this with people's own awareness of their own uncertainty? So, for example, you might be able to direct people to think, let's say I'm giving you a car that can range between $300 and $300. Do you want to get information about it? And I might ask people, what is the likelihood that you'll be wrong? If I ask you to guess now, what is the precise price of the car? What is the size of the error that you expect? So that may draw people their awareness of their own uncertainty. Because again, instinctively, we prefer to think about things that we know, and we prefer to not think about things that we don't know. So maybe to be a more efficient information seeker, you should pay more attention to stuff you don't know. So these are the kind of questions that we think about. How would we train people and nudge them to do better?
Really interesting. And another data set you collected was the series of personality surveys. Why do you think that personality might influence how people gather information in this way?
That's another very deep question. And I can answer it why I thought of it first, and then I can give you the deep answer. So the reason I thought of it is just because it feels like it should be important. And people, whenever I was presenting, I was giving early presentations of this data, that's what everybody was asking. What about those people who did better? What about people who did worse? What about their education? What about their political affiliation? What about the usual questions that people ask? I think that it turned out that education is not a predictor. Interestingly, even people who are trained in statistics don't get this correctly. Not more than the general population.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so we did personality traits. In the first paper, we did a set of them. There are many personality questionnaires you can use. The ones we used in the first paper didn't really give us anything interesting. The second time around, we got better, and we did find some correlates of personality. And actually, it's the personality results that made me come up with a second hypothesis that maybe it's not the conflict induced by the reward. Maybe it's the ability to use uncertainty and reason about uncertainty. Because the personality predictors that turned out to be important had to do with the attitudes to uncertainty. So one of them was stress tolerance. We know that uncertainty is associated with some degree of stress. And we found that people who score higher on stress tolerance do better on our tasks. So maybe those are people who are more accustomed to think about uncertainty and how to reduce it. So maybe what happens in some people is, oh God, I can't even think about question. I can't even, if people are very stressed out in dealing with an uncertain situation, they might just avoid it altogether as opposed to trying to reason and reduce the uncertainty. So that was really interesting to us. Another thing that came out was something like this behavioral inhibition system, which indices reactivity to errors. So there's some people who are really averse to making errors. And what we hypothesize is that because they hate to make an error. So for example, if I ask them later to predict the cost, they just hate to make an error. So therefore, they have more incentive to think about how should I get information so I can predict an error down the line. And then we have another indicator, which is need for cognition. And that is a preference for thinking deeply. Somebody who likes to solve puzzles or to challenge themselves intellectually, or people who like art, a complex material. Those people did a bit better in our study. So then we think that this ability to deal with uncertainty, reason about uncertainty, could be really quite important. And again, we're pursuing those personality metrics. So now I said I would give you a deeper question of why personality traits. And the answer goes back to the metaphor of the island and the ocean. Again, we are these beings who live mostly in an island of the familiar, but are always aware of the unknown. Within the domain of the familiar, we have defined entities, and we can reason within defined entities. We know this is a car, this is an apple, this is a restaurant. And we know the implications of each thing. And we know how we'd act in a car, in a restaurant, and so on. And we know what goals those things. So if you notice all of these, we don't need that much emotion in there. We have content and we can reason on it. And that gets us to our goals. We need the emotion to be motivated to eat and to be motivated to pursue good things. And if we're totally depressed and don't care about anything, the whole thing wouldn't work. But apart from that, these are not super emotional, arousing states, right? It's just more routine. But then in the ocean of uncertainty, we don't have those defined entities. That's the point about uncertainty. We don't know what a UFO is. We don't know what a cloud is. We don't know what it means. What would I do if the cloud looks like this or like that? We don't know. So I think that what the brain, I think this is really a huge role of our emotions, is to signal the motivational valence, the approach, the threat, the relative threat or hope that there is out there. Again, we cannot be specific. All we can have is a diffuse sense of something, and that something is good or bad, right? It's a very diffuse thing. An emotion is a very diffuse thing, but it's really vital to tell us how to approach something in order to, do we want to make it more concrete? Do we want to learn, right? So now personality is really a set of emotions and a set of emotions that we tend to have over and over, and it's some sort of stable constellation of emotions over the lifetime and attitudes toward things. So this is why I think that attitudes toward uncertainty will really be related to some sort of emotional states, and they will be reflected in our personality because of that. Because uncertainty by definition is not something where we have detailed information that we can reason on. And so our information, the little information we have, is conveyed through these diffuse emotional states.
Wow, what a fascinating thing to think about. Absolutely. I think as we wrap up here, are there any sort of last thoughts that you want to leave our audience with about this field and your hopes for the future?
Yeah, I really hope that in the future, we will really talk about these things a lot more. Already, I have seen over the past decades, I think there has been a tremendous increase in the interest in these questions. People who are looking into curiosity exploration, and actually, it's becoming super important with the rise of artificial intelligence, because in a sense, the problem that is faced by any sort of autonomous artificial agent, it's a self-driving car or a drone, is indeed those agents live in a sea, in an island of a little bit of information that the programmer coded inside it, but that's limited. And then you send that machine into a world that to it has a vast amount of uncertainty. And you cannot, in any realistic world, you cannot control the environment. You cannot pre-program every single contingency the machine will encounter. So you have to give it some ability to deal with uncertainty. And so this active exploration thing is super practical importance. And also, I think importance for understanding anything interesting about how people behave, psychopathology and anxieties, and also weird decisions that people make, which are all over the place. The apparently inefficient ways that people learn, how people are motivated, more motivated, less motivated to learn, all that. It's just super, super interesting and important. And I really hope that we will see more focus on these questions. And yeah, so that's what I'm hoping.
Wonderful. It has been such a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for joining me.
All right. Yes, it's been a pleasure too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. For those who are curious, Professor Gottlieb's lessons were actually read. We would love to hear what you think of this episode or a podcast in general. Or if you have any other suggestions for future guests or topics for the podcast, you can reach us at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. Please help us make more people excited about psychology. by leaving us a review or subscribing to our Substack at Stanford SciPod to connect with other listeners. Thank you and have a wonderful day.